This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who, if you take the time to get to know them, you're going to find they've done some pretty incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, we're inspired, and many times amazed by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm pretty amazed at the story of Chuck Beatty. He is 91 years old, and he spent almost all of those 91 years in Modesto, California, where we are today in the studios of KFIV, which airs the show every Saturday morning at 6 on Power Talk 1360 and 1280. And we're gracious for the studio space to do this interview today. So let's go way back, Chuck. When you were growing up in this Modesto area, I believe when I drove in today, the population sign said 203,000. I don't think there were that many people 91 years ago.
No, I rather imagine the population probably, when I was born here, was probably around 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
But has since grown, naturally.
Just a little bit.
Yet.
What do you remember about growing up in this area before World War II?
It was a farm town. Of course, most of the time I lived in the country on various areas in the Modesto area, and then plus Oakdale and surrounding little surrounding towns.
Wherever your father could find work during the Depression?
Right. Well, he was with the Bank of America, known as California Lands, and that's what he was with them. Probably until about 38 or 39 that he left them and went to work for the local John Deere dealer.
Well, and I was just thinking, I'm sure there are a few farmers listening to this program, and they're probably saying, hey, I know that guy. I bought a tractor from him once upon a time. You spent 42 years selling John Deere tractors.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how often in those conversations people found out that you served time on two different World War II submarines or the USS Yorktown, and you survived its sinking, which maybe people remember from the Battle of Midway. We're going to talk about all that. But tell me first, December 7th, 1941, mm-hmm. What do you remember about that day, and how did you find out what happened?
Well, at that time, my weekends, and I worked at a service station about the attack and everything. Of course, when I went home that evening, it was on the radio. My folks were listening to it and everything. So I told my parents that I wanted to go into service. I already had a brother in the Navy already, so I wasn't 18 yet, just a few days short of it. My dad signed the papers for me to go in on December 9th. He did that on December 10th. I turned 18, so I didn't need his papers. So I joined at that time and was sworn in on December 13th. December 13th, I was sworn in.
You know, you say that, and maybe that didn't catch people, but that's pretty significant. All you had to do was wait one day and you didn't need his signature.
Yeah, right.
But it was that important for you?
It was.
What made it that strong of a desire or a driving passion that you had to join the Navy?
I don't know. I think being I had a brother in the Navy, and another thing, I thought if I ever waited for the draft, I don't know whether they'd come to draft, they'd either put you in the Navy, Army, or Marines. And I just thought, well, I'd rather have the Navy than to go into the Marines or into the Army. So that's one part of why I joined up.
Simple as that.
And I had no animosity about the Japanese. That really didn't, because I had so many Japanese friends. There's a lot of Japanese families in this area, Durlock area. And I was friends to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And those people, I had no bad feelings at all about them.
You signed up so quickly, you probably weren't here when those Japanese friends of yours were rounded up and sent to internment camps.
No, huh? I wasn't, but my oldest sister was, who had been a Secretary of Scouts here for a good number of years, had worked with the families in the scouting deal, and she was one of the people that participated in assigning these people to various camps. Some of them came back here after the war, and I still have friends with two friends that I went to grammar school with. One of them still alive.
How about that? All these years later. What were you thinking when you got in the Navy? What were your expectations? What do you think this big adventure was going to be?
I really didn't know. Had no idea of what I would be doing outside of, I would be in the Navy. That really was about the only thing. I wasn't looking for any adventure or anything. It was just something I felt that I wanted to be involved in.
Mm-hmm. So. I mentioned the Yorktown. You got on the Yorktown at a really interesting time. It was in the Battle of the Coral Sea in May.
Mm-hmm.
And then in June was at Midway, and in between those two major battles in the Pacific early on in the war, they brought aboard a young sailor named Betty. How did that all happen?
Well, when the Yorktown came into, I was stationed at what they called a section base at Hawaii, where section base, they, as they needed people, they drew them out of that base. Of course, when the Yorktown came in, she came in on the 28th, I believe it was. The 29th, I was assigned to her, and the 30th, we left for Midway, and I was on her for a total of 11 days.
Some pretty fateful days.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, while you were there in Hawaii, this is only 6 months after Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
What was Pearl Harbor like then? Could you still see the Arizona or the Oklahoma turned upside down?
I came into Hawaii on the 12th of January of 42.
So just a little and more than a month after.
Just a month after the war, and it was... Of course, all the battle wagons that were sunk that were disabled in that and laid in as you came into the port, there were four of them that you could see. That it was quite a sight to see, but it was a horrible sight to see.
Well, that's what I wondered. Yeah. What that does to you emotionally to see. I mean, you've seen the pictures and the film, but to actually be there that close to when it happened and see what's still left there.
What the section base, as I say, we had daily... They would pull work parties out of that section base for the day, and they had the duty of going around, and we were collecting body parts around the shore. And we did that for, assigned to that for 5 days, and then that's all they let us do. Then we were pulled for various duties until the Yorktown, when they needed somebody, where there were five of us went aboard the Yorktown from the section base, and we went aboard as ammunition handlers is what we were doing. Start out with, we were loading the ammunition aboard her, and then, of course, when we went out to sea, then they had us, we were carrying ammunition from below up to the, on the deck to supply.
And I'm sorry for bouncing around on you here, but it's just hitting me here. I'm thinking about, we've got kids getting ready to graduate from high school here in Modesto that are already 18 years old. Here, you're 18 years old. You sign up as soon as you can after Pearl Harbor. A month later, you're at Pearl Harbor pulling body parts out of the water. At 18 years old, were you prepared for that? I mean, how do you deal
shocking.
With that?
It's shocking. Well, it wasn't very nice, let's put it that way, but it had to be done.
I mean,
it was, you know, it was that was one of your duties. You accepted it, that it had to be done. That's why I think they only limited you to 5 days. I think they felt that it was... our age that we were that at that time, I think they thought it would be too much to go beyond that 5 days.
The emotional toll.
The emotional cost. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how did you process that emotionally? Did it motivate you more to get out there and meet the enemy?
Well, yes and no. Actually, your thoughts more were the people that were lost. Of course, you did make you madder and everything about it, the way it was done and everything, and the attack and everything was done, but of course, you didn't know, as I say, daily you went back to section base, and you didn't know where you're going from day to day, so you really didn't, you didn't know what you were going to be doing, so you didn't really, in your mind, say, well, I want to do this or I want to do that. You were just going to do what they assigned you to do. That's what it was.
So it just strikes me that here you are soaking in the aftermath of a tragedy, of an attack that drew America into the war, and less than 6 months later, you would find yourself almost being the victim of another tragedy at sea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you mentioned getting aboard the Yorktown, and your job was to carry ammunition?
Right. I was in what they call the X Division that they assigned us to on the Yorktown.
Did you actually have the occasion to do that in battle, to carry the...
That's what my duty was to carry ammunition. I carried 50 caliber ammunition is what I carried to topside.
Mm-hmm.
I would take it up to topside, and I would give it to another handler if there was one there. But if there wasn't one there, then you got up on deck and started going someplace until somebody would come and get the ammunition from you.
That makes sense. You guys leave Pearl Harbor on May 30th.
May 30th. Mm-hmm.
And 5 days later, you're in the Battle of Midway.
Midway.
How did that battle begin from your perspective? When did you know something was happening?
Well, they started launching when we were out about 4 days, they started launching planes to look. They're looking for. They knew the Japanese fleet was coming, so they had the launching planes to try and find the Japanese.
So while that's going on, are you carrying ammunition or
not at that time? No, the only time we carried ammunition was actually during the battle time. That's the only time they needed it.
So, but at this point, they're launching the planes. They're going to find the Japanese, and before long, the Japanese are coming to you.
Right, they were. In fact, they never, as far as any of the planes aboard the Yorktown, did not find anything. But it was a PBY or PBM, PBR flying boat that actually discovered the Japanese. Mm-hmm. And of course, remoted their position and everything like that. And that's basically, you might say, within 10 hours, 12 hours, we were in battle with them.
Yeah, and the Battle of Midway would be a great victory for the Americans, but not for the Yorktown.
No, but it was the turning point of the war.
It was the turning point of the war. There were four Japanese carriers there, and three of them were sunk by the American planes, some of them from the Yorktown, bombing them. But so you're on the Yorktown, and you just said 10 or 12 hours. What was that time period like for you? What were you doing, and what did that feel like?
Well, of course, a lot of the time before we went to battle, the thing, we actually didn't have anything really to do, with the exception of they would have us repositioning some of the ammunition for a different area, so where they were going to take a topside in that. So that had that. But outside of that, why? Probably scared as hell, let's put it that way, of what you look forward to, you know, what could possibly be, because some of the fellows that you're on there were there on the course we battled.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, they knew what it was like.
So you're scared before the first bomb hits.
Right. Mm-hmm. You can't say you're not, because you are scared.
And then the first bomb hits, and the second bomb, and the third bomb, and two torpedoes. How close were you to any of those, and how did you experience those attacks?
Well, of course, second day of the battle, when we got an explosion on the deck, got my knee splintered, and so I was out of there until they took us off, put us aboard a destroyer to take us back to Pearl. This is after the time that they're almost getting ready to abandon the Yorktown entirely.
Mm-hmm. So that must have hit pretty close to you.
Well, it
for you to be injured by it.
Yeah, it did, because I wasn't that bad off as some of the people were. I had knee injury bad, but I mean, there's others without legs, without arms, and whatever.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic, or I know you're not looking for attention for it, but tell me what you were doing when this happened, and what exactly happened to your knee.
Well, I was, as I say, carrying ammunition, and of course, this one time I went up, there was nobody to receive it from me, so I went on. You could see the 50 caliber positions. So I just went on and started carrying ammunition to one of the 50 calibers, and that's when we had the explosion. It was on the deck, and that's when I got the shrapnel. I say shrapnel, or whether it was wood splinters or what. I never did know really what it was.
And was this from one of the Japanese bombs?
No, it's from a Japanese bomb. Mm-hmm.
So a bomb hits your ship, and the explosion sends something into your knee.
Mm-hmm.
What did that feel like?
Sore. Well, it was startling. I mean, you can't say what did you think. All you knew that you were hurt, and you were trying to be calm about it. I mean, like, I don't know how to say it, but you weren't screaming or anything like that. But there were some of people that were, but they were hurt.
Did it knock you down?
Oh yeah, it knocked me down. It knocked me off my feet, but good.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I tried to get back again, but because right immediately I had no feeling at all in that leg. I had no feeling whatsoever, so I didn't know it until I started standing up that it was. So.
And someone figured out that you were hurt?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I did myself, but I couldn't stand on my leg. I got up, and I just wouldn't stand. So.
And if your job is to run ammunition from one spot to another, it's kind of hard to do that without...
Right. So.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't a short time out that a pharmacist mate was there with some bandages and that.
And they got you off the ship pretty quickly?
Well, no, we stayed on until 2 to 3 days after that before they started taking the wounded off. And then they just put us on a raft, and then, of course, the raft went to the destroyer.
and they would get you back to safety. And I have some more questions about all of that, which we're going to get to after the break. You can find photos of the Yorktown during the Battle of Midway and of Mr. Betty on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. But here's the most sobering reality. More than 300 Americans died during the Battle of Midway. In addition to the carrier Yorktown, a destroyer was also lost, and more than 150 airplanes became casualties as well. When we come back, we'll explore those final moments of the Yorktown as Mr. Betty experienced them, and we'll find out why, after escaping a ship that was going under, Chuck volunteered to serve on boats designed to go under. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf, and the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Chuck Betty of Modesto, California. He was just 18 years old and had been on the USS Yorktown for just days when that aircraft carrier suffered what would prove to be fatal wounds in the Battle of Midway in early June of 1942. Wounded in the knee by one of the first Japanese bombs that hit, he was still aboard, feeling pretty helpless as the battle raged on and bombs and torpedoes continued to batter the Yorktown. The battle started June the 4th. The Yorktown went under in the early morning hours of June 7th. Like the rest of the wounded, Chuck was evacuated before the ship went under. But for all that time, while you're still on the ship, unable to do anything to defend it, what was going through your mind?
You're worried. You don't know what's going to happen next because of the beating that she was taking at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you just wondered, well, is she going to stand it? Are they going to sink it right now or what? You just really didn't know.
What would have happened to you if they did sink it?
Well, you don't know, really, Paul, what's going to happen. Of course, they take as much of the crew off as they can. I guess going by it in the past and reading the history of it, they took a lot of the wounded off after they realized she was going to sink, another possibly sink. Mm-hmm. It's when they started taking all of the crew and everything else off of her. So you knew that something was happening that wasn't good when they started doing the evacuation that way.
And again, I'm just going to ask you a few crazy questions because I wasn't there. None of us were. You were. The timing of it all, when you were wounded, that preventing you from continuing to ferry this ammunition, could that have saved you from getting injured worse?
Oh, I'd say yes, definitely. I think it could have saved me, saved my life, actually, let's put it that way. Because you didn't know the way that the attack that was being made on her, why it was... anybody. If the ship could have been hit anywhere, and there were a number of them that were killed during that attack that were up on the deck.
Yeah. So there's no telling where you would have been because you covered so much ground in that role, and one of those bombs or torpedoes could have killed you.
Killed you, right.
But instead, you're recuperating. They finally evacuate you. When did you find out that the Yorktown sank?
Oh, we knew that about 4 days or a week, something like that, that they tried to salvage her because she was listening and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say it was probably word got out almost immediately at the time that they really abandoned her and called her lost. They gave word to the crew, the people that were in the hospital and the crews that had been abandoned and put elsewhere on the shore. They just got the news that way.
But you knew when you were getting off the ship that there was a chance that might happen.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Because she was, when they took us off, she was pretty badly damaged.
Was that still, I know you hadn't been on the ship very long, but was that hard to hear that it had gone under?
Oh, yeah, you do, because the war at that time, in other words, was going, before the Battle of Midway, the war was going the Japanese way. Mm-hmm. And having to lose a ship like that that could give so much more to the war, you just felt sad for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just something hard to take, unless a good ship like that. Now, there are others that were lost also, but I mean, the one that you're aboard, you're more...
And that was the biggest one.
Right.
That was the carrier.
Yes.
And again, you're 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Is youth an advantage there? Do you not run through all the scenarios in your mind, or do you find yourself saying, boy, all those guys died, that could have been me?
Well, right, you do. You know, I don't... In my part, I don't know. I can't say that I was scared, but I really wasn't real scared. I don't know how to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, the things that we went through in the service, I just had no fear. I'll put it that way. I didn't have sense enough to have fear, maybe. And at that age, I think that's what it is for most young people.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Well, I was guessing that you didn't have any fear, because here you are, the first ship that you're on. Get sunk by the Japanese, and you go and volunteer for submarine duty. Because I don't know if everyone understands this, but if you are going to wear the dolphins like you're wearing on your submarine vest right now, that takes volunteering during World War II. It wasn't something they were going to assign you to. You had to step up and say, yeah, I want to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What possessed you to do that?
I had talked to a fellow that was aboard a submarine, and when he was in the hospital that I had met, and he was aboard the submarines, and he said, just tell me this, how good a service it was and everything. You got good food and everything like that. And it was kind of exciting. So, and there was another chance that if I volunteered for submarines, I knew I was going to be sent back to the States.
Uh-huh.
Because I knew I'd be going back to submarine school.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I shouldn't gloss over that either. You mentioned being in the hospital. How long did it take you to recover?
But I was in the hospital a little short of 3 months.
That's quite a long time.
Yeah, it was a little short of 3 months.
You say your knee got splintered. That's a pretty severe injury to keep you down for 3 months.
Yeah, of course, I say 3 months. It was probably the last 20 days or so. I thought I was well and everything. I could have gone out of the hospital. But,
mm-hmm.
of course, the doctors and that, they're the ones that are going to tell you where you're going, if you can get off or not. So.
Sure. And, again, I know you're not asking for sympathy but... Be honest with me, is that something that did fully recover, or has that knee bothered you ever since?
Fortunately, recovered. Fortunately, I had the doctor at the submarine said when I went back to submarine school, there was a doctor there that was a specialist in bone structure.
Uh-huh.
They operated again there and put screws and that into,
mm-hmm.
in that. So mobility-wise, I have trouble occasionally with it, but I don't. It's never stopped me from doing anything.
I can tell you're getting around great for 91. Yeah. So you say volunteer for the submarines, and part of that was going back to the States. So you know, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get sent right back out into the war. I'm going to have some time at home to train.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Was that training difficult?
No, it was not for me. It wasn't anyway. Some of it was kind of exciting and you have the tower that's a 138-foot tower that you put them on some lung on and put you down at the bottom of it, and then you're supposed to go up that 138 feet with that Munson lung.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some people, it was startling and everything, but you were breathing air out of the lung.
Yeah.
But some of them couldn't quite stand it. Some of them just couldn't do it.
And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to submerge.
Right. You're disqualified. Mm-hmm. They were very, at that time, they were probably most lenient on who could get on and who couldn't get off. But there were some of the things that if a person could be confused or startled like that, that you just didn't accept it.
And you were just showing me some pictures of you aboard the World War II submarine Pampanito that's in San Francisco. You can go visit it and tour it. And anyone who's done that realizes that submarines in World War II were a lot different from what we know today.
Definitely they are. We had more room than they do today.
But you couldn't stay under as long as they
could. No, that's true. We couldn't.
And you got used to the smell of diesel, didn't you?
Never bothered me. Smell never bothered me at all. Uh-huh. And in fact, I don't remember the smell of diesel. To me, I never did.
Yeah?
No.
Well, explain to folks how those diesel submarines would work, that you guys would have to surface how often to charge the batteries?
Well, you did it daily is what it did. And generally, as a rule, it was at night that you're up running at night. You would run on the surface a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And that time, of course, you were charging the batteries. I think the longest that I can remember that we were down was 72 hours, which was quite a while. In other words, the oxygen began to get a little thin and that, but other boats have been down longer than that. Mm-hmm. But it's entirely different, like you say, the new boats today.
And they are boats. Don't call a submarine a ship. It's not a ship. It's a boat.
Right.
And the first boat you were on was the Bashaw?
Bashaw. Mm-hmm. I did one patrol aboard her.
Where were you guys?
Out of Fremantle, Australia. They had the submarine tender there called the Uralie. Put along there for repairs and that in between patrols.
And what was your position on that sub?
A torpedoman. I was a torpedoman with my rating. Before I did that to get out to the islands, to Australia, after I got through submarine school, they signed me to a repair base in Brisbane, Australia. At that time, we used to have the Lurline used to go between San Francisco and Hawaii as a cruise ship. Mm-hmm. She could do 27 knots, so they sent us to Australia with no escort whatsoever. We just went by ourselves. And we got into Brisbane and the crew there, and we stayed there 3 weeks, and they shipped us to all the way across to Australia to Fremantle. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it took us, we went by train, and then in Australia, every state you got into, they changed the gauge, so you had to change trains and everything. It took us 9 days to go from Brisbane across to Fremantle.
Wow.
But,
this is a whole lot of the world you're seeing as a teenager and a young man here.
It is. But then, as I say, when I got over the relief crew over there, I was only on the relief crew about less than 6 weeks when Brashaw came in off of patrol. And my rating was torpedoman, and they had a torpedoman that advanced in his rating, and that put them too many men in that same rating. In other words, so they transferred them to another ship, and then I went aboard her as a third. At that time, I was third-class torpedoman when I went aboard her.
Explain to all of us how that works. If you are in a situation where a torpedo is going to be fired, what are the steps that you go through?
Well, of course, both times I was in the forward torpedo room. When you go into battle, you prepare your tubes and everything for firing. You're waiting for the commanding officer to tell you to fire. Of course, most of the firing was done in the conning tower by an officer. If we had to be, we could fire from up there if the emergency came on. But outside of that, we were just waiting. And if we did fire the torpedoes, immediately we were putting new torpedoes in the tubes to have them filled.
Mm-hmm. So. And that is one thing you can see if you go to San Francisco and visit the Pampanito there, that they do have a torpedo in the tube, and you get a pretty good look at how that worked. So you say you made the one patrol.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that took you from that boat to the other boat, the Sea Robin?
Well, because of the fact that the Sea Robin needed a third-rate torpedoman. Uh-huh. And the Bashaw.
You had more than you needed.
More than they needed, so that's when they... I went to relief crew, and then immediately was transferred to the Sea Robin after that.
On your vest right now, you're wearing a couple patches that pay tribute to the Sea Robin.
Sea Robin.
You've got a couple of birds riding a torpedo, and the other has a whole lot of Japanese flags around it.
Yeah, that's from the Sea Robins. That's her flag.
Yep.
And the...
And that means that that boat took out a lot of Japanese ships.
Right, they did. They had a pretty good record for that. Late in the war, we had a pretty good record.
Tell me about that. What would give me an example of one of those patrols where you guys encountered Japanese ships and then were able to sink them?
We run on surface wherever it was possible enough without endangering the boat. Some of these that we sank during the day, but a number of them were at night. You got excited about it when it was happening.
That's what I was curious how. Yeah. It's not like you guys all have a window or a TV screen.
No.
Or even a radar readout. How does that word spread, and what is that like on a submarine when you find out, hey, that torpedo hit its target?
Well, the thing of it is, when you fire a torpedo off, you always were waiting for to hear the explosion and that. Or, of course, the commanding officer a lot of time was on the intercom when they say, well, they're looking through the periscope and see it. Well, it was broken in two. The ship was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you got your word, what was going on from the torpedo that you fired.
And then what happens on the boat when that announcement comes?
Oh, everybody's, you know, you're, well, good. We done something. We sunk something.
Yeah, a little cheering.
Really, you just got ready for the next one is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you were in an area where you had five or six ships. So you was hoping, well, you got the one, can we get another one out of the same group? But the majority of the times you didn't, because it was by the time you fired that and got off, well, a lot of times you had the Japanese were after you. In other words, they got contact with you, and they were trying to sink you, too. So.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. And when you were on the Yorktown, I know it ended up sinking, but had you been aboard as it's going down, at least you would have been able, maybe, to survive in the water. If you're on a submarine and you get hit by depth charges,
well,
I don't think you're surviving.
In order to sink a submarine, the depth charge has to be awful close to it. I mean, I'm real close to do it. Where a lot of times we heard depth charges, but they were off at a distance to where they were doing no damage, but you'd hear them going off.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them that were a little closer, you kind of gritted your teeth a little bit. But I just don't know. I don't think I ever remember one or felt that I was scared because of it. Maybe I didn't have sense enough to, but I didn't have any fear of what it was.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. I know you've got a story of one of your own torpedoes almost took out the Sea Robin, and I want to get to that. But as far as any Japanese threat to your boat, what was maybe the closest call or most nerve-wracking moment you experienced?
Of course, I think it was when we did get into a convoy, and we sank one of the ships, and then the Japanese destroyers were more or less targeted on us and were dropping depth charges constantly. And of course, at that time, most of the time, you go into silent running and you just try to get right down on the ocean bottom, just sit down on the ocean bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And been in some where it rocked the boat. I mean, close enough to rock the boat in that, but there was none of them at any time that I knew that ever was a danger to the Sea Robin. They just weren't that close.
When you talk about diving deeper and sitting as low as you can, is that a helpless feeling while you're waiting that out? Is there a sense of expecting something to happen?
You always know that something can happen. You're in silent running, so the best thing you do, you don't talk, you don't do anything. You just sit there and be quiet.
So you're alone with your thoughts.
You're alone with your thoughts, really, is what it is. And you can talk. There's no that. And amongst yourselves and everything, you're talking. And it's just a conversation going on. Well, are they getting any closer, or how long are we going to be down, or what? I mean, it's just like that. It was just abnormal not to be afraid, I'll put it that way. And I think that's where a submarine sailor had it over a lot of them, because they, I don't know, it was just the idea that you could face problems a little easier. And myself, I'm comparing myself back to the Yorktown. Mm-hmm. In other words, the difference between the two.
I guess you were a little older and more mature by then, too, but you lived both realities, so you're pretty qualified to speak to it. It's break time again, but more of Chuck Betty's story, including how one of his submarine's own torpedoes almost ended the war for him. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 91-year-old Navy veteran Chuck Betty, recorded at the studios of Hometown Heroes affiliate KFIV in Modesto, California, where Chuck lives with his wife of 69 years, Priscilla, better known as Penny. Two children, two grandchildren, and three great-grandchildren would have never been born if Chuck did not survive the Battle of Midway aboard the ill-fated USS Yorktown. Some great photos from that battle on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. He told us about volunteering after that to serve on submarines. He said that even though he faced some pretty intense and imposing circumstances, he didn't really feel fear. So why was that? Where did that come from? What convinced you that things were going to work out?
I don't know. I guess it goes way back to when I was a kid that I had never had any fears when I was young of anything. I think it just was part of me that way. I knew fear, but I didn't have it that much of it. I don't know. It just helped that you didn't have the fear. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just that you could perform your duty a lot better than you are if you are afraid of it. And as I say, people say, well, you don't have any sense if you don't have fear. Well, I guess I didn't have any sense.
Well, I'm sure your wife of 69 years has an opinion on that one.
Yes.
So one of the things I enjoy about this show is we always learn something. And there are so many things about World War II that are so much deeper than what we understand on the surface. And I don't know if anyone out there, you know, for instance, people might not know that the Japanese had suicide submarines just like they had suicide airplanes. But another thing people might not know is that American submarines had magnetic torpedoes that would be fired off. So in other words, along the lines of a heat-seeking missile, this magnetic torpedo would be drawn to the closest big enough metal object.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you guys had those magnetic torpedoes on the Sea Robin.
We did. Mm-hmm. The one patrol we had them.
And it almost took you guys down.
Well, we fired a number of them. None of them ever to have any effect.
Really?
Whatsoever. We did fire this one that went out so far and then all of a sudden changed direction and just started circling around us. Going around and around. Well, of course, that's when we went to silent running and went right round to the bottom. But until it ran, until it just ran out of power, out of electricity,
mm-hmm.
is what it did.
But you see, you're describing that real matter-of-factly, and I'm just trying to put myself back in your shoes on this submarine. Obviously, you fired it because there was something you were firing at.
Right, that, correct.
Mm-hmm. A Japanese ship.
Yes.
But it didn't hit a Japanese ship. How do you guys find out that it's circling around
you? Oh,
you
hear it. Our sonar hears it. They hear it.
So it keeps pinging, going around in circles around your ship.
Yeah.
And when does that fear set in that, hey, this thing could actually hit us?
There's no doubt that there's fear there. But I never let it bother me.
Yeah.
Again, you know that everything, the captain's done everything he can do to protect you and help you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you're sitting on the bottom and this thing is going around and around, but it didn't seem to be getting any closer than what it originally was when it first started circling. Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a panic aboard the boat?
No, there's none whatsoever. Not that I ever knew of anybody panicking on it, no.
And I'm sorry if this sounds like a dumb question, but just so everyone out there listening gets it, what would have happened to you if that torpedo hit?
Oh, if it went, it exploded probably. Although there's some of them that didn't, you'd hope that was one of them.
You can pray it's a dud.
Right.
But if it's not, you're not here.
That's right. It had sunk us immediately. It's what it would have done if it hit us.
But it didn't.
But I think that was the last the acoustic torpedoes that I know of. I think they stopped putting them out at all. I don't think any of the boats carried anymore. Because they weren't that successful. They weren't
clearly
at all.
Yeah.
They weren't that successful.
There were a lot of different things that got tried during those days. Mm-hmm. So how many patrols did you make with the Sea Robin?
Two. Uh-huh. Made her last two. She made three patrols totally, mm-hmm. and I did the last two with her. We came out of Fremantle, Australia, and did our patrol. And at the end of that patrol, they sent us back to Honolulu, to Hawaii, mm-hmm. for repair there. We were given 2 weeks rest period. And, of course, in Hawaii, we stayed at the Royal Hawaiian. That was our headquarters.
Nice.
So we were in port probably totally, I would say, less than a month. Uh-huh. Because once we went back to the boat, of course, you had some trial runs and that before you head out to sea again. So then the second patrol, we were going to be in Midway. We were headed back to Midway. And that's where we pulled in when the war, we were there when the war quit. And that's where we were going to hold our 2 weeks with the Goonie Birds.
Isn't that interesting? Here, you almost died at Midway.
And we're back there at the end of the war.
Did anybody else on your boat know about that? Know that you had been on the Yorktown there?
No.
You think they would have believed you if you told them?
Oh, I don't know. I think they would. I mean, we weren't one to give any bull to one another. No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
But of all the places you could have been at the end of the war.
Other than Midway, right.
Midway, where the Yorktown sunk after you were on. What did that mean to you to hear that the Japanese had surrendered?
It was a big relief. You were just looking forward to going home. You know, things were over and you all you could think about, well, let's get home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done our duties now. It's time to get home. We left Midway and went to Honolulu. And stayed there for 10 days before we started back to the States. And they, of course, we went through the Panama Canal. On our way back to the Panama Canal, a lot of times we would flood down and fish. We had ate a lot of fish for dinner. When the Sea Robin first left the States, we lost one of the crew overside. And he was from Galveston, Texas. That's where he's from. So the captain requested for Navy Day if we could go to Galveston, Texas, which we did. We pulled in there and had to Navy Day parade, riding a torpedo and pulling through the streets.
How about
but it was in honor of the young fellow that we lost overside.
So you did that to honor someone who'd gone over the side, and I'm sure you're also aware, because so many guys like you have told me over the years, pointed out the distinction that if you want to take the highest percentage of any part of the service where they suffered the worst casualties, the greatest percentage was in the submarines,
right, it was.
There's a lot of those boats on eternal patrol.
Patrols, there are a lot of them. I don't remember the total.
I think it's 52.
I was going to say it was in the 50 figure that there were. That I was lucky, that I was one of the lucky people that survived it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that a lot of people had a worse time than what we did and everything. But it was just looking forward to getting home. I think that's one of the, when we left Galveston, where we just headed back to New London, Connecticut. As soon as I got back to New London, where we were given 30 days leave. I went back home and spent 2 weeks there, and then I came back. My wife, who at that time I was engaged to, she was in New York. And, well, she was actually in Montclair, New Jersey at that time. Mm. I went back and spent the last 2 weeks my leave with her.
When did you get engaged?
Well, see, I had to stop and think. It was 1945. At the time, I was sending my sister and brother-in-law money every month to save for me. So I wrote my sister a letter, and I said, would you you and Al pick a engagement ring and that and send it to Penny for me? Well, unbeknown, I never notified her. All she did was remember on this, just at Christmas time, is when it was, that she opened up, and that was a ring there. That's what it was. I got a letter a short time after that, the next letters we got, whether she had accepted.
So you had been together before you went overseas?
Yes, we had. Well, we'd been together probably total days, I would say maybe 12, 14 days totally. It was all that we were together.
And, but I mean, before you, via mail through your family members, asked her to marry you. Yeah. Pretty unique way to propose.
All right.
Before that, you guys had dated for a while back home?
Yeah, that's what, yes, we had. The fellow that I was going to submarine school was from here, from Modesto. We got good friends. He was going with a girl that was in the same school as my wife was going to, St. Agnes School in New York, is what it was. And her mother lived in the Lexington Hotel in New York City. So they would come down on weekends and stay with her, with Sally's mother. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we would go to her mother always, when we came down, she would reserve us a room, Lee and I a room to have while we were there. So I don't think it was over 14 days totally that we were together at all.
So as unique as that proposal was, with the engagement ring being mailed to her, it worked. Married 69 years later.
69 years, right.
What's your secret? What advice can you give the rest of us who want to be married that long?
Take the good with the bad. That's all I could say. We've had 69 wonderful years, and we plan to have a few more, too. So.
And a few months ago, she was one of those waiting for you at the former Castle Air Force Base. When your plane came back in from Washington, D.C., you went with Central Valley Honor Flight to see the National World War II Memorial. What did that do for you? What'd you get out of that?
Hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
I look back and think the Army and the Marines had hell. I don't know. It was quite a salute to go back and see the awards and and I think the most one I was impressed with is the statue of Okinawa.
Oh, Iwo Jima.
Oh, Iwo Jima, I meant, yes. Yeah. I was most impressed with that statue, I will say, because there's such detail. Mm. It's such a detail in the statue. And, of course, I enjoyed each and every one of them, but as I say, I think it impressed me more than any of them.
What did it mean to you at the World War II Memorial? Every veteran seems to be moved by the wall of gold stars that represents 400,000 who died, and you came close enough to being one of them. But also at the World War II Memorial, there are different battles that are memorialized in granite, and one of them is the Battle of Midway.
Midway.
Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you to stand there and look at what it said on that wall?
Memories. It brought back memories of on there. My son-in-law went along as my guardian on the trip. Gary asked a lot of questions, you know, that was on it at the time we were there.
Mm-hmm.
But it brought back memories, is what it did. I enjoyed the trip to no end. I really appreciated it.
Did it leave you feeling that people appreciated you and what you did?
Yes, I'll put it this way. The people that backed this honor flight make you know that the people appreciated you by making it possible for us to make the trips. And I know they go on all over the United States because I get it on my internet of various areas that have made the trip. Ours is a 3-day trip. A lot of them are only a 1-day trip in that. So it makes you feel good that some people remember you and are thankful for it.
Well, I don't want to forget to thank you myself. Yeah. So thank you for serving our country and for telling us a pretty unique story that not too many people can tell. Yeah. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we should know?
Not that I could think of, Paul, no.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Having served. Again, people ask me, how would you do it again? They should do it right now as far as I'm concerned. But I would go. I enjoyed doing what I did. I really did. I enjoyed doing what I did on board the submarines. I would go right back and do it again.
And I think we can all tell you do a phenomenal job. That is Chuck Betty, a survivor of the USS Yorktown at Midway, and also a survivor from our submarine forces in World War II. Here are those figures that we were alluding to. It was indeed 52 U.S. submarines from World War II that are now on eternal patrol. More than 3,600 men died serving on those primitive subs, including Thomas Wilson Griffin, that 31-year-old from Galveston, who was the only one from Chuck's boat, the Sea Robin, lost during the war. I'm sure you'll join me in saying that I'm so thankful Chuck was not among that number and thankful that we could hear from him today. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and please join us again next time for another journey back in time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.